comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
This is talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It really is. And the reason it is because, you know, we always say it's the show where you matter. We have partners, I guess you could, that's a good word, partners, all around the world, people who partner with us in the development of these shows. And as you will see tonight, this show tonight is as a result of one of your suggestions, and we appreciate that. So it is the show where you matter. Some of the folks in our audience, all of our audience matters, but some of the folks in our audience live in New Zealand. And in New Zealand today, they had a 6.3 earthquake at Christchurch, New Zealand. A number of people have been reported dead. Scores are trapped. Scores of people trapped. The airport is closed. Some of the buildings have just collapsed and people are trapped inside. Look, our best thoughts and prayers for all of our friends in New Zealand, those who listen to the show and those who don't. These are very tough times in Christchurch, New Zealand. Emergency rescues are underway. And as I said, our best thoughts and prayers with all the folks there in New Zealand. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. Now, this newsletter is a good one. Don't let the word free throw you off course. Usually, if something is free, there's no value to it. That's not the case here. The free weekly newsletter is something we started back in 2000 and have continued right up till today. Started out, it was just a text email. Today, it's a pretty spiffy looking newsletter. And so you need to get it just to see what I mean when I say it's pretty spiffy looking. But beyond that, it's always got articles that pertain to this genre. You get the inside scoop on this show. You get articles that pertain to this genre, to the things we talk about here on the show. You get links to interesting videos, sometimes very important videos. The audience feedback section is there, so things that people write to us, we can't get them all in there, but we put some of the emails that we receive each week in the K-Files. And there's always a free download of valuable software. So why not? It's free. Now, some of you emailed me and told me that you tried to subscribe and there was something wrong. It just wouldn't do it. Well, we went in and don't really know what the problem was, but we reworked. It looks the same, but we reworked the code, and I think it should be working for everybody now. So if you haven't subscribed, be sure you do. We'll be back with my guest, Jim Nichols, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I think it was last year, I spoke at a meeting, a little one-day mini-conference gathering in Tucson, Arizona. After this, a group of us went out to eat. Jerry Wills and Kathy were there, Kathy Wills. I was there. A number of other people that had been part of this meeting were there. And in the group was someone that I had heard of, had no idea that he was in this group at first, but his name is Jim Nichols. That's where I met Jim Nichols, having lunch with this group of folks after that meeting. And when I was introduced, I think I was introduced by Jerry Wills, I was introduced to Jim Nichols. I said, well, yeah, you know, why haven't I had you on the show? And he laughed and said, well, I don't know, and he handed me his card. I'm an old guy, and I forget things, and I stuck that card in my wallet, and there it languished. Well, I've gotten some emails recently, a couple of emails from folks saying, you know, I really wish you would have Jim Nichols on. And, you know, here's his website, and they gave me a link. And the thought hit me again, why haven't I had Jim Nichols on? Well, I have corrected that, and Jim is here to help me correct it. Jim, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hello, Kevin. It's nice to be with you. I'm glad you found that card.
Well, look, you know,
as I recall, that was a very good meeting. You gave us a presentation on Mars. It was very, very interesting, very informative.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, that's the one where I showed a cow and a Cadillac and asked people, how often have you gotten these two mixed up? When you see a cow and somebody tries to tell you it's a Cadillac, you'd get upset, wouldn't you? And,
exactly.
Of course, my audience has heard me use that example many times. But,
yeah,
well, that was a good meeting. We had a good time, didn't we?
We did, yes.
Was it Jerry Wills that introduced us?
Very possibly. I've known Jerry for a long, long time. And years ago, I used to do a TV show here in Tucson with Ted Lohman.
Yeah.
And on occasion, we would have Jerry Wills on our show. So,
you know, I've seen that show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have watched that show, and a lot of people around the country have. Folks, Jim Nichols is one of the, I guess you could say, most famous UFO illustrators in the country. His paintings of UFOs and UFO events have appeared in all kinds of publications. But in addition to that, he's a heck of a writer. And if you go to his website, if you click on his picture at my website, it will take you to his website. Once you get there, you can look at all these pictures, and wow, we'll share some of them tonight. But also you can click on, he's got blog entries down the side, and if you click on those, you can read some of his writing, and we're going to talk about some of that tonight as well. He's just very, very accomplished. And Jim, now you've got a book out that's about 40 of these illustrations that you've done, and in the book you give the backstory, the untold story of these illustrations. Tell us the name of the book and how can people get it.
Well, the book is called Case Files Revealed,
mm-hmm.
The UFO Art of James Nichols. And you can go to my website, actually, jimnicholsufoart.com, and you can actually purchase the book directly from a link there on the website. But over the years, I've done a lot of UFO art since 1980, when I first started. And so I thought, well, I would just pick like 40 of my favorite pieces and put them in a book, and tell the background story of each painting, Some, in fact, are based on actual UFO cases, and others are more speculative UFO paintings that I've done, and some are just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of actually, and if you read the text and go along with the pictures in the book, it's kind of a thumbnail approach or kind of a thumbnail overview of the whole UFO phenomenon, and which is kind of what I wanted to do, just for people who are kind of, you know, kind of borderline and kind of interested but curious. It's a nice, easy way for people to kind of ease themselves into this area of research.
One of the things, Jim, that caught my eye at your website immediately, mm-hmm. is the masthead right at the top of the page.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. On the left side, you have your rendition, if you will, your version of the Roswell crash, as I believe based on Wendell Stevens' testimony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the right side of that same graphic, you have the Roswell crash, the object that actually was reported by some people to have been found. But it's based on Kevin Randall's description of it.
Mm-hmm.
Same event, different descriptions. The one that Wendell Stevens described and you painted is the classic circular flying saucer.
Right, right.
The one that Kevin Randall described is, if folks think triangle, but think of the corners as being rounded. And very sleek-looking craft. Now, Jim, do you have an opinion as to which one of those is probably more accurate?
For me, the jury's still out on that one. Actually, the first one I did was in '92, and I just wanted to do. There were so many crashes in the Southwest in the late 40s, early 50s, I thought I would just do kind of a generic UFO crash scene that looked like it would be in that time frame,
mm-hmm.
where you saw Army personnel around the craft and so forth. But then, this is like 92, I'd only been doing the TV show for a year at that point. But then in 97, of course, that was the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of Roswell. And so I wanted to do another painting that was maybe a different point of view, and there were significant groups of eyewitnesses who claimed, no, it was not a circular ship, it was more like a flying wing. And so I thought, well, I think just to honor both points of view, I would do another rendering specifically for the anniversary, which was another more specific to eyewitness claims of the UFO crash at Roswell. So that's what the second one was about.
Well, the second one looks more like what Kenneth Arnold described. And folks, if you're new to the genre and you don't know the name Kenneth Arnold, a day or two before the Roswell crash, very shortly before the Roswell crash, was flying his airplane. He's a private pilot. And he was flying in Washington State, and he saw a group of odd-shaped aircraft. And he said, he reported it, and he said they were skipping along like saucers on water. Well, the news media picked up on that, and some reporter called it flying saucers. He never described the craft as being saucers. Never. He described them as moving like saucers that you skip across water. But the craft that he described, and those who are watching our television channel, are looking at a picture of Kenneth Arnold holding up an artist's rendition, a sketch of what he saw. And it's a bat-winged craft. It's like a flying wing, but it's very, very futuristic in its design. And that's what he saw. He didn't see flying saucers. He saw this.
You know, that's interesting because what he shows there looks more like a flying wing.
Well, it does. And in fact, the Germans had a design very similar to that.
I was going to say that. Now, that leads to another whole line of research, is that the Germans had flying wing aircraft at the end of the war. And it's also speculated that a joint American-Canadian interest not too far from that area of Washington State in western Canada was perhaps test flying some of those captured flying wings. So there's... you know, there's also this strange German component that pops up from time to time in the whole UFO issue, and this may be one of those.
Well, it's entirely possible because this is shortly after World War II.
1947, right.
Yeah. And so shortly after World War II, and we now have reports that the U.S. went in and scooped up as much of that super advanced technology from the Germans as they could scoop up, right along with the scientists, as many as they could. And, you know, they said some magic words and used their magic pens, and those guys became Americans. And they were brought over here with Project Paperclip.
Project Paperclip.
Yeah.
Imagine 300 boxcars of captured rocket components rolled across the United States right after World War II, captured V-1, V-2 rockets, wound up in White Sands, New Mexico, and that became our rocket project,
mm-hmm.
our rocket program, and who was a major player in that but Wernher von Braun.
Wernher von Braun was a major, not just in the German military, he was a major in the SS.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a high rank. A major is a high rank. And but, you know, they said the magic words, waved the wand and brought him over. And Wernher von Braun was the guy responsible, most responsible, for guiding the programs that eventually took us into the Apollo space program.
Exactly, right. I mean, I remember as a kid watching the Walt Disney TV show where they would show Wernher von Braun, and he'd be talking about his moon project, and he had this model of this rocket ship that was going to launch men to the moon, and eventually over the years that evolved into our own Apollo project.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the blogs that you wrote, one of the articles that you have posted on your site, is all about, and I may not say it like you do, but the Aldebaran mystery. And folks, if you're looking on his site, you look at that list of articles on the right, I believe it's what, number 14?
I believe it's 14. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those who are watching, I printed it out. And it's, as you can see, a long article. It's got lots of illustrations in it. And it goes into a lot of this information about the Nazis and, in fact, their UFO program, if you will, their flying saucer program. You also have in here a picture of a Vimana, and I wanted to ask you, Vimanas, of course, are mentioned in the, I believe it's the Mahabharata.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the writings from ancient India. Mm-hmm. Is this picture, is it your rendition, or is that someone else's?
No, that's someone else's. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because it looks like a ziggurat, except mm-hmm. instead of being having corners like a pyramid, it's circular, but exactly. built well, like a wedding cake.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done any illustrations of a Vimana?
No, I have not approached that one as yet, but I've certainly done a lot of reading about it, and it's a strangely fascinating piece of ancient history, especially in that it relates to the possibility that in ancient times that they had tapped some kind of free energy technology that would allow them to create levitating ships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is fascinating. Someone that I can't remember who it was, but someone that has appeared on this show as a guest said that there are even in those ancient writings, there are even instructions about how to build them, how to make the fuel. It talks about a pilot training program where they trained humans to fly them. So it's, really fascinating, especially when you realize just how ancient that is.
Well, you think about that, and then just prior to World War II, at the rise of the Third Reich, they were sending teams of archaeologists and so forth into the Gobi Desert, into Tibet, into these areas, and, like in the Indiana Jones flick, they make it look like the Germans are kind of whacked out and they're kind of crazy and they're obsessed with ancient cultures or anything. But I think they were crazy like a fox because they were aware that there were these ancient technologies that they wanted to rediscover and capitalize on, because if they could, and if in fact they were free energy technologies, it would completely liberate them from their dependence on petroleum, which was pretty much monopolized by the British and the Americans.
Yeah, they really had a petroleum problem in the prosecution of the war. Mm-hmm. And that became painfully evident in their Africa campaign in North Africa. But it was painfully evident throughout the war, really, in all the theaters of the war, but really was driven home to them in North Africa.
Absolutely. But this, you can see that this would certainly give an impetus to their need to find and try to discover these kinds of technologies that would have given them, had they capitalized on it, maybe a completely different advantage over the Allies.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes people think that if it has anything to do with Hitler, that it's 100% evil. And he was a bad guy. There's no question about that. But there were some little droplets of good that rained out of those clouds. A few. Okay, look, we have to take a break. We will pick up right here when we come back. So don't go away, folks. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Jim Nichols. Jim, we were talking about you had mentioned that the Nazis had sent out teams of archaeologists and scientists looking for all of these ancient technologies around the world. And I had said that, if you mention Hitler or the Nazis, people automatically think evil, and they were. But even in that, there were some little droplets of good that fell out. And, look, folks, how many of you drive a Volkswagen? Do you not realize, had it not been for Adolf Hitler, there'd be no Volkswagen? He's the one that gave the order that there had to be a people's car, and the Volkswagen was invented.
And
so
people enjoy their televisions.
I'm sorry?
How many people enjoy their televisions? The first television broadcast was the Olympics in Berlin in 1936.
Well, there you go.
These are all technologies that we have advanced and are just commonplace today.
Yeah. So, look, They were evil guys, but in spite of all of that, some good, some little drops of good were wrung out of all of that. And I'd by no means, so don't write me the hate mail. I am not praising Hitler or the Nazis. I'm just pointing out the fact that some of the things that we have today are little droplets of good that came out of even that very evil system. Now let's talk about this Aldebaran mystery. What's this about?
Well, that's kind of what I was going to talk about. At the outset, and between wars, at the end of World War One, there were these secret societies in Germany, and one in particular was called the Vril Society. And it was a group based around these ladies who were psychics, who were, we would think of as like more like remote viewers now, but that in those days they were psychic, they were mediums, who claimed to have made contact with an extraterrestrial civilization in the Aldebaran star system. Now, for those who don't know what Aldebaran is the brightest star in the constellation of Taurus, which is in fact the eye of the bull. The brightest star in Taurus constellation is Aldebaran, and they believed that they had discovered a civilization on a planet that orbited that star. And they, through automatic writing and so forth, they were given instructions on how to build what was believed to be a time machine. And this is around 1919. This is almost 1920. There was a physicist who joined this group by the name of W.O. Schumann from the University of Munich. And he looked at the writings and some of the instructions that were being sent to them. And he said, you know, this looks like some kind of actual viable physics that we might be able to work with to make some kind of either time machine or flying device out of this. So the whole Nazi saucer mythos evolves from this mediumistic contact that happened with beings from Aldebaran.
Now, a key figure in all of this was Dr. Hermann Oberth. What role did he play? Because he made some pretty amazing statements later. So what role did he play?
Well, to my knowledge, he was not directly involved with the saucer project as such, but he was aware that German technical people were getting information or data from extraterrestrials, and he flat out stated that.
Yeah, he did. What he was involved in was he was a pioneer in the rocket designs,
right,
for the German Reich during World War II, and he made the statement, "We cannot take the credit for our record advancement in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped." And then when he was questioned about, okay, helped by whom, his response was, the people of other worlds.
Exactly. And this is a statement he made much later when he was working with the American rocket program. But it was more W.O. Schumann who was more directly involved in the design and the prototype of the flying discs that were built in Germany just at the very start of World War II. But, you know, like you mentioned earlier, it's like the Vril Society did not have the ambitions, I don't believe, that the Nazi Party had. And you got to understand, and this is characteristic throughout the human race, the human experience, is that there's this desire to create a utopian society. And this was like the heart of what the Vril was all about. They wanted to create a utopian, free energy kind of society that would benefit everybody, not just Germans, not just the nation of Germany, but for the entire world. And in a very idealistic sense, this was a beautiful idea. But along comes Adolf Hitler and his group and the Thule Society. They borrow from these ideas, and they think, well, the only way to create a utopian society is to tear down the old society. So in a sense, Hitler himself didn't see himself as a villain. He saw himself as tearing down the old order so that the new order or a new age could come into being. And it's like, it's so tragic because this is a well-intended idea that just became totally twisted and evil and became the monster that we all know as the Third Reich.
And yet in the Third Reich, although I guess you could say they were born of a bad seed, nevertheless, they did discover some things that really could be and maybe have been of great benefit to us. I mentioned the Volkswagen, but in the scientific field, they discovered many things that were not known previously. After all, folks, the first people to fly a rocket in, you know, as a military weapon, well, that was the Nazis. And it was the follow-on of that Nazi development of rockets that pretty much was the creation of the space program in the United States of America. And I have read, perhaps you can tell us, Jim, I don't know, but I have read that some of the scientists were the ones that weren't taken by the U.S. and brought here under Project Paperclip were taken to the Soviet Union and developed the rocket programs there.
Exactly. Well, that, even in the early 50s, that's when, why there was so much panic about flying saucers, because you know, the Pentagon was well aware of the German scientists that the Russians had, and they were concerned that, well, are the Russians developing flying saucer technology based on what the Germans had come up with? And were we facing a flying saucer threat that was actually from the Soviet Union, not necessarily from outer space? So this has always been an additional component to all this.
So it's sort of one of those, it takes one to know one. We knew we were trying to develop it and had
exactly.
German scientists
exactly.
and some of the technology,
exactly.
and we figured they did too.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Aldebaran mystery then, it's centered on the UFO technology. When I say UFO, I should say flying saucer technology. That the Germans were reputed to have developed. And that was based upon this physics that had been, I guess you say, channeled from people on Aldebaran to the Vril Society.
Exactly.
Okay, so the connection then is that there was some real physics that came out of this channeling.
Well, that's the myth. The problem is we can't actually put our hands on that physics. There's tantalizing references to it here and there, but is this one of those secrets that was absolutely classified at the end of World War II, and we to this day still don't have access to it in like the public domain here? There were two distinctly separate flying disc programs that were that the Third Reich was involved with. One was called Unit 7, I believe, that was strictly a Luftwaffe program that was using conventional turbojet engines to create flying disc machines that were actually precursors to are modern helicopters. That they it was more like a flying gyroscope kind of thing, where the fan blades or the propeller blades would be around the cockpit, the pilot's cockpit, and with conventional using conventional kerosene aircraft fuel, they would fire up these turbojet engines to create lift, vertical lift, with these kind of machines. But these are strictly conventional machines. These were not exotic technology machines. And I've been told that they spent more time in maintenance than they did actually flying. That they did get them to fly, but they were not very reliable. Now, there was another generation of flying disc craft that were strictly within the auspices of the SS. And this was called Unit SSE-4. And if you look at some of these alleged photographs of these craft, you will see the SS, or you will see the lightning rune, which was symbol of the SS, on the underside of some of these craft. Now, this was the absolute cream of the crop, top secret flying disc that the Germans were allegedly building, and they ran on free energy. They used some sort of mercury vortex engine technology that created a discrete levitation field. A discrete gravitation field where the craft actually levitated. It did not fly in the traditional sense. These craft had their own discrete gravitational field separate from the Earth, so they levitated. They didn't fly. So this is the technology, this is the super secret technology that we're still trying to get a handle on today.
I'm going to show our audience on the TV channel one of your depictions of a German craft. And it's just a Nazi flying disc. We see it looks almost like a photograph. We see a disc levitating above the ground. We see two German, apparently, officers standing on the ground looking up at it. You mentioned that there are some photographs of these flying discs, and you call them alleged photographs. I want to get into that when we come back from this break, and we will be back right after this, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Jim Nichols. He is an award-winning illustrator of UFOs and UFO incidents, etc. He's also an excellent writer and a UFO researcher himself. Now, Jim, I said I wanted to talk about these pictures. You called them alleged photos of the Nazi flying discs. Why do you call them alleged?
Well, I call anything that can be absolutely proven as authentic is alleged in my book. Now, these are very intriguing photographs, but there's no way we can prove that these are actually authentic.
What's the source of these photographs?
Well, back in 92 or 93... at a UFO convention, I met a gentleman from Bulgaria, actually. His name was Vladimir Terzisky, and he knew all about the German saucers. And at that convention, he presented a collection of photographs that as the story went, they came from a Russian source, and they were originally released in Australia. And eventually they showed up in a video called UFO Secrets of the Third Reich. But they're very, very intriguing, very remarkable photographs that certainly suggest that somebody in Germany was developing something truly exotic as far as flying machines.
Okay, so this guy from Bulgaria shows up at a UFO convention in America. He's got mm-hmm. photographs that he says are from a Russian source. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand why he called it alleged.
Right. So there's
but what do you think?
Track it down and prove. But they're all over. If you look up German saucers on the internet.
Yeah, I've seen them.
You can see these pictures for yourself. Just, you know, make up your own mind of how authentic they are.
Now, Hans Kimmler, who was, we don't hear as much about him as we hear about Heinrich Himmler, but they were apparently buddies. Hans Kimmler had earned a reputation for very rapid development of underground facilities, manufacturing plants, etc. And he was responsible for, if I'm not mistaken, he was responsible for the underground manufacturing area at Peenemünde. Is that right?
At the end of World War II, Hans Kimmler was in charge of all top secret weapons projects for the Third Reich, which
okay.
would have included the rocket program at Peenemünde and the SSE-4 flying disc project as well.
Now, you've brought up a very interesting period of history, and that is at the end of World War II. It is alleged, and this kind of goes along with the, you know, talking about why the pictures are alleged photos of the, well, they are photos, but they're alleged to be genuine photos of genuine Nazi flying discs. So sort of on that same track, it is alleged that there were a bunch of U-boats or a group of U-boats that left Germany and went to Antarctica, and that aboard these were some of the key Nazi leaders and scientists and some of the key top secret technology. And we've all heard the rumors that there's a Nazi base, or was, maybe still is, a Nazi base on Antarctica. And in fact, you've done a painting of some U-boats off the coast of Antarctica with some flying discs above them. So what do you know about that? Did that actually happen?
Well, this is the Aldebaran mystery that I wrote is really an overview of the myth of the German saucers, and this is definitely a component to that that myth that the Germans annexed a portion of the Antarctic, which was originally Queen Maud's land. It was a Norwegian territory. And when the Germans took over Norway, they annexed that portion of the Antarctic for Germany. They called it Neuschwabenland. And allegedly in that particular area, you got to understand, the Antarctic is not just a block of ice. The Antarctic is a continent,
mm-hmm.
is a landmass. So they discovered that there was thermal heated freshwater lakes in this area, and there was also natural resource like coal deposits. So this was a prize for the German Reich to actually claim this land. And as you mentioned, there's a manifest of, I think there's 100 U-boats that at the end of the war were not accounted for. And what's also interesting, and I learned this fairly recently, there was a U-boat that was sunk off the coast of Norway that had 40 tons of mercury on it. Now, mercury is allegedly one of the main components in this anti-gravity levitating technology, this mercury vortex engine technology. So why would a U-boat be carrying 40 tons of mercury, which even to this day is an environmental threat to the ocean in that area? All the puzzle pieces kind of fall into place because, okay, they have annexed this chunk of the Antarctic, and then you also have, like you mentioned, Hans Kammler, who's an absolute genius at creating underground facilities. So the U-boats disappeared at the end of the war. Hans Kammler disappeared at the end of the war. And then in 1947, the United States launches a full-blown naval task force to go to the Antarctic, led by Admiral Richard E. Byrd.
Mm-hmm.
This was a combat task force sent to the Antarctic that was equipped to stay down there for 8 months. It stayed down there for 8 weeks and turned around and came home. So this is like I said, there's so many strange aspects to this story that just don't get answered properly.
In your article about the Aldebaran mystery, there is a photograph of a long cylindrical object that is supposed to be a Nazi design. I think it's 300 feet long, can carry 5 of the discs inside. Where did we find out about that, and did they ever actually build one of these?
Oh, that's a real good question. That was called the Andromeda machine. It was as big as a Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was allegedly, I think it held 4 of those mercury vortex levitation engines. And it was as, at least as big as a U-boat, as big as a submarine.
Uh-huh.
Imagine a Nazi U-boat that flies.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about here. Now, there is a story of a United States Army counterintelligence group that went into the Harz Mountains after World War II. Pay attention. They went up into the mountains, and they found this huge cylindrical machine that had been covered with camouflage and so forth. All the engines, all of the control components had been stripped out of this thing, but he says it was as big as a Nazi submarine. Well, why would they be building submarines up in the Harz Mountains,
mm-hmm.
you know, hundreds of miles away from the water? He believed that this was, in fact, they had come upon an abandoned shell of one of these Andromeda machine levitating cylinders.
That's interesting because, well, I'll tell you why that's interesting when we come back from break, because we have a break coming up here in just a few seconds. But it's not the only place where a so-called submarine has been found in the mountains, and one of them was fairly recently, relatively recently. So on the other side of this break, I'll tell you about that. I'll also get Jim Nichols to respond. Maybe. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Jim Nichols. And those of you who are just now joining us in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you're here. And my sincere sympathy for you, for whatever it is that kept you from the first hour. Now, Jim, when we went away for break, you had just told us about how right at the end of World War II, some Allied troops go up into the mountains in Germany, and they find this long cylindrical thing as big as a German submarine. And all of the controls and technology has been stripped out of it. It doesn't look like a submarine, but it's as long as one. 5 to 7 years ago, somewhere in that neighborhood, there was a report out of South America of government agents, I don't know which country, I can't remember, but they found, as it was reported, a submarine being built up in the mountains. I think it was in Peru. It might have been Brazil. I don't know. It could have been some other country. But it was in South America. And I know some of the folks who are listening to the show tonight, especially our audience in South America, will remember that. And they were puzzled about why would they be building it, a submarine up in the mountains. They didn't find the builders. They just found this long cylindrical object, and they said it was a submarine, and they surmised that it was to be used for smuggling drugs. How are you going to get it down out of the mountains and get it to the ocean?
Right, right.
Do you remember hearing about that?
No, I just saw a piece where some of the drug lords in South America are using submarines.
Yeah.
But these are submarines that are actually in the water.
Yeah.
Why would you build a submarine up in the mountain? Unless you're related to Noah and you know something that the rest of us don't know. But that's an interesting story. I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, you'd have to do some digging and research to find it, but that was reported by mainstream media, lamestream media, and it was 5 to 7 years ago. They speculated that somebody was building a submarine to be used for drug smuggling. But the big question then is, okay, so how do you get it down out of the mountains?
Right.
And how do you get it to the ocean? I don't know. But South America is one of the real hot spots for UFO sightings, as well as, when we say UFOs, most people think flying disc. It's anything in the air that is unidentifiable by conventional measurements and conventional means, but yet it's up there. That's a UFO. And that includes these cylindrical UFOs that have been seen, photographed, and videotaped in South America.
Well, then you add into all this, you add the George Adamski stories.
Okay.
And the cylindrical craft that he claims that he photographed, which looks very suspiciously similar to the design of the Andromeda machine, which allegedly was being designed. I'm not sure that they actually built a prototype, but I rather suspect from this other information that they had that maybe he saw a actual flying Andromeda machine that had been built, in fact, by the Germans.
Now,
because the whole George Adamski thing, the craft that he claims he saw, the craft that he claims he photographed at Silver Springs, Maryland, is almost identical to the Honeybu II, which was also a design built by the Germans in World War II. So it's like,
well, you know, not only do we have the problem, as you have pointed out, of being able to nail down and verify source information on all of this, not only do we have that, we have the additional problem that if all of that information, let's assume that it's true, and the Germans actually did succeed in building and flying discs. Let's assume that's true. Now, we have, once we assume that's true, we have the additional layer of problem in this. After World War II, we have Kenneth Arnold seeing this bat wing type aircraft. Very similar to what the Germans were designing, and that we know. But the problem is, was it captured German wing craft? Or did the Germans copy something from extraterrestrials, and was it the extraterrestrial craft that they saw, that Kenneth Arnold saw?
Absolutely.
That layer of problem, once we assume that all that information is true, the next layer of problem is, are we looking at advanced German craft, or are we looking at extraterrestrial craft?
Or a hybrid of both. Hybrid of both.
Yep.
So that's the whole myth that we're talking about. I really need to, just so I don't get a lot of people thinking that I'm a neo-Nazi or something here, this is certainly not, my interest in this story was certainly not to celebrate the Third Reich. My focus is that I feel like, ironically, we have come full circle from that era right after World War I, where here we are trapped, stuck with, we're virtual slaves of petroleum technology, and it's like I have the same feeling that the people of the Vril culture or the Vril society had. It's like, can't we come up with a free energy technology that would benefit all of humanity? It seems like we've come full circle to asking that same question once again. Is there a technology that all humanity can benefit from that is free energy and that would be virtually comparable to what the Vril Society had stumbled upon in 1919?
Well, you know, there's the story, and you included in this very excellent article, that the story that President Dwight Eisenhower did have a meeting with extraterrestrials, and there is some anecdotal evidence of that actually happening, which we've covered on this show previously. But it was supposed to have happened in 1954. And there, according to this story, there was a group of extraterrestrials, I don't know really where they were from, but they offered to give him and the United States technology for free energy. But in exchange, they wanted the United States to give up its nuclear weapons. And as the story goes, President Eisenhower refused the offer. Now, in your article, there's some pretty interesting information, additional information, in that Pope Pius the 12th was also contacted by these extraterrestrials. What do you know about that? Why did they contact the Pope? He didn't have any nuclear weapons. And what did they offer him?
Well, as the story goes, and this is based, this is a conjecture that came out like 2 or 3 years ago from a Vatican source that claims to work within the SIV, which is the Vatican equivalent of the CIA. And this comes via Cristoforo Barbato, an Italian UFO researcher. He tells the same story that Eisenhower was met when they, and he said very specifically, they were Pleiadians, that the beings that originally offered Ike the free energy technology were Pleiadians. And it was, and like you say, Eisenhower turned down the deal. He said the Soviet Union was too much of a threat, and that we just couldn't just unilaterally disarm our nuclear arsenal. And subsequently, another group stepped in, extraterrestrial group, which were allegedly the Greys, and they came from Reticulum. And they offered President Eisenhower advanced technologies in exchange for access to the genetic material of the United States population. They told Ike that their species was dying, and that they would be glad to give us technology if we could provide them with genetic material that would revitalize their species. Now, according to the Italian source, the Pleiadians subsequently met with Bishop Edward Mooney from Detroit and James McIntyre from Los Angeles. And eventually, those two gentlemen were essentially liaisons for the Vatican with these Pleiadians. And eventually they said that Pope Pius XII actually met with him also at the Vatican Gardens there in Rome.
Did they say for what purpose?
That they were cutting a deal with the Pope. I think they wanted, as I understand it, they just wanted to let the Pope know that the United States had made a deal with extraterrestrials that could not be trusted.
Okay, so this was just passing on information to the Pope.
As far as I know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to invite you to join us here in this discussion. The way we do that is we open up the telephone lines, and the telephone lines are indeed open. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. Toll free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. If you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free number for you, but I do have the flash message option at my website. So you can go over to kevinsmithshow.com. If you don't wish to make the international long-distance call, then you can click the link, which is to the right of the picture about tonight's show. You just look for Jim Nichols' picture on my site. To the right of that, you'll see a link that says Flash Message, and you must be outside the USA and outside of Canada to use that. But we invite you to join the show, because invariably, after every show, I get email where people say, well, I just wish you had asked this. I wish you had said this. Well, I do my best. But like I say, my mind's pretty sharp for an old guy, but I'm not God. I can't think of every question, and I can't make every comment. So we invite you to step in here and partner with us and help us with the discussion. 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889 is the main number. Again, the toll-free number, 888-223-4599. That main number, though, you can call that from anywhere in the world. It will work from anywhere on planet Earth. If you have a telephone, you can dial country code 1 and then the number 623-444-5889. Now, Jim, you have looked into this Aldebaran mystery quite thoroughly. And I appreciate the fact that you have backed off, and so, you know, when I've pressed forward with some statements, you've backed away from some things, and you've said, well, that's alleged, you know, because we can't say for sure this or that. And I understand that, and I can appreciate that, and I do appreciate it. What's your gut feeling? Did the Nazis actually establish look, first of all, we know they established a base in Antarctica, but to what extent and for what purpose, I don't know. So, and we don't know in the general public. So, what you got feeling about that? Did they establish successfully a UFO base or a flying disc base in Antarctica?
My gut instinct, and actually I kind of mentioned this. I also have a video. I produced a video about this as well, called The Aldebaran Mystery.
And it won an award.
Actually, I won two EB awards last year. If the whole myth had ended at, you know, when the Germans signed their surrender in 1945, if the whole UFO issue and a Foo Fighter thing, if the whole thing had ended right there, I would say that this is just poppycock. This is just tabloid nonsense. But there's so much more stuff that happened in the years following World War II. And like you mentioned, the Kenneth Arnold sighting at Mount Rainier, the George Adamski story, the George Adamski photographs. But the biggest problem I have is Admiral Byrd's task force that went to the Antarctic, specifically to the Antarctic, in 1947, in early 1947. And then they claimed that, Admiral Byrd claimed that they had encountered, how did he phrase it, aircraft that could fly from pole to pole at high speeds, extremely high speeds. That's a very cryptic statement. And then again, in the fall of 1947, it gets even better. Wendell Stevens was assigned to a Strategic Air Command Air Force Base in Fort Richardson, Alaska. And that base was established for the specific purpose of mapping and photographing the North Pole. And during these overflights of the pole, the B-29 crews also reported flying discs. They had flying discs that dogged the aircraft. They had flying discs that they saw parked on the ice pack. They saw flying discs coming in and out of the water. They were photographed. All the photographic evidence of these sightings were classified, locked up, and sent by courier immediately to Washington, D.C. And Wendell Stevens said he never got to see the actual footage that these was taken up there, but he got to debrief the flight crews and heard firsthand the stories of what the pilots were seeing flying over the North Pole. So it's like, there's just one little thing after another, just following World War II, that suggests that the boys in Washington knew about some other serious UFO mystery that they were not talking about, and they don't talk about to this day.
All right, let's go to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, guys. This is Brian up in Washington.
Yeah, Ryan.
Oh, very interesting show tonight.
Thank you.
I want to give you guys my personal... Is it okay if I give you my personal sort of hypothesis or speculation?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
It's total speculation, and I don't... just my hypothesis that it appears that, to me anyway, that the Nazis did contact a blonde-haired race from Aldebaran or whatever the star system was, but they used it. They weren't capable of handling this technology, and it drove them. It might be the where we got the original source of the atomic bomb and nuclear technology. I just think that, I don't know for sure, but it just seems to me that It appears that the Nazis were so far advanced that they had to have had some help from off-worlders, and I'm not a fan of the Nazis. They were evil, you know, Hitler and everything else, so I don't want to get the...
Yeah, but, you know, to be fair, morally reprehensible, but technologically very advanced.
Yeah, that's right. The paradox, right.
So possibly they now are still shutting down our nuclear arsenal and our nuclear weapons because they are the ones that gave us that technology, and we were not ready to use it. They don't want us to destroy ourselves. That's my hypothesis anyway. I could be wrong, but that's just what I
think. Yeah, well, that's interesting. I let me just add something here, too, that the according to Wendell Stevens, he said the people from Aldebaran, they offered this technology in a very benevolent fashion. It's like you can't blame the Aldebarans as being the architects of the evil of the Third Reich. They agreed with the original philosophy of the Vril Society that, yes, that free energy technologies would allow for more exchange between nations, and that would actually design to reduce belligerence and stress between different countries, and that this would be something that would promote peace on this planet. And they offered these technologies as an assistance to make this planet more peaceful. And the whole thing just got totally twisted out of its original intent.
All right. Ryan, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Very interesting hypothesis. Well, you know, if you look at the Wright brothers at the beginning, the very early stages of the 1900s, they finally put together something that you could call an aeroplane, and that could carry humans. Technology has advanced very, very rapidly since then. Now, I think that we should not shortchange the brilliance of some designers, engineers, physicists, etc. We should not shortchange that. And look, what was it, 1905 when the Wright brothers flew the first time? Was it 1905 or 1902?
1904, 1905, around that time. Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, by 1917, the U.S. military had the Wright brothers building airplanes for them.
Right.
Okay, so it didn't take very long to get from we can barely get off the ground to a machine that the military was ordering and was having built for military purposes. It's just like that, a big leap ahead in the technology. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back from this break, we will continue. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Jim Nichols, and we are talking about UFOs this evening, and particularly the UFOs as dealt with in Jim Nichols' article and award-winning video called The Aldebaran Mystery. The telephone lines are open, ladies and gentlemen. The telephone number worldwide is 623-444-5889. If you're in the USA or Canada, there is a toll-free number if you need to use it. It is 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you may use either that main number, 623-444-5889, or because I don't have toll-free outside the USA and Canada, you can use the flash message option on my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com. Just go there, scroll down, you'll see the link on the right side of the picture about tonight's show that says flash message. Jim, how much credence do you put into the story about Eisenhower meeting with these extraterrestrials?
Oh, man, you put me on the spot now. That's one of the stories I've heard forever in the UFO field. And it's like, that is too preposterous to be believed. And I just could not wrap my head around that. But then over the years, it's like more and more people were coming out of the woodwork saying, yeah, this really happened, and da-da-da-da-da. And I think it was after the events and 9-1-1, it made me question that, you know, is our country really going down the right track anymore? And is someone or something engineering where our political structures are going? And it made me question, well, who's really in charge here? Are we in charge here? I mean, President Eisenhower warned us when he left office in 1960-61 about the growing threat of the military-industrial complex. And it made me really stop and think, you know, who's the military-industrial complex answer to? And so you go back and so you go all the way back to Roswell and rethink this whole UFO issue all over again. And it's like, who did, if I did make a deal with extraterrestrials, did they have an agenda for the United States? Do they have an agenda for the world that we're not privy to? And if you read Phil Corso's book, Day After Roswell, there's some rather disturbing implications in what he had to say. Where the people in the Pentagon were suddenly questioning, well, who's really in charge here? And are we answering to an off-world agenda that we on planet Earth have no awareness of? So that's where I went back and started to re-piece together the Eisenhower myth. And it's like, who's in charge of this country? The Federal Reserve can misplace $9 trillion. And not bat an eye. I said, well, where did that money go? And what is that money being used for? And are these monies being used for something that it does not benefit the people of this planet? And is this an agenda of somebody else from someplace else? So that's why I went back and to re-examine the whole Eisenhower contact issue and say, what has happened to this country since
so what was your conclusion? So what was your conclusion about the Eisenhower alleged meeting with you extraterrestrials?
Well, actually it goes back to the crash at Roswell and Harry Truman. Harry Truman set up what would be MJ-12, which was a clandestine government within the government that had total autonomy. No matter who was president in the White House, this particular group, military industrial complex group, had complete autonomy and was directing policies that the rest of us maybe would not have agreed to. So that's it's an area of research for me. The jury is still out on this one. But there are some serious implications of what may be, you know, directing our national policies and military policies and the intelligence community policies that are not directed by the people that are paying the bill for it.
Well, if we assume that the stories of Eisenhower's meeting with these extraterrestrials, if we assume that that story is real, and that it genuinely happened, then what we've got is Ike Eisenhower, who warned us about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, actually giving a bow and a nod to the military-industrial complex. Because if the stories are true, then President Eisenhower turned down free energy because he would have to give up nuclear weapons. Had a later meeting with another set of extraterrestrials, which today we call EBs. They promised technology which could be used for warfare. He accepted their, if the story's true, he accepted their offer in exchange for your blood and mine.
Exactly.
So that means that this beloved president did us in.
Right. But just to be the devil's advocate, I can't fault Ike because they had him over a barrel. They had demonstrated that they had technologies that we had absolutely no defense against. So it was like Ike was backed into a corner where he saw his only option was to capitulate to this surrender, which essentially is what it was, in order to buy time to where we could get technologies to put ourselves on par with these creatures to where we could defend ourselves and take back our autonomy. I hope that that was exactly what I had in mind. And I give the nod, the benefit of the doubt to Eisenhower on this issue. It's like if I was in that position, I would probably make the same decision.
All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Clay from Arkansas.
Yes, Clay.
Is some of your paintings oil?
I don't understand the question. Is some what?
But most
some of your paintings, acrylics. Are they oil?
Oh.
Some of them are done in oils, but most of them are done in acrylics.
Oil, it's quite hard to work with. I'm tinkering with that right now.
It takes too long for it to dry.
Yeah, 2 weeks. But anyway, my question is, some of the German officers, due to the time travel program, they disappeared. I wonder if you could address that, and I will hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay, Clay, wow. Thanks.
That's a loaded question. I know that they were working on technologies that probably were involved with time travel, but I don't specifically know. I don't know that specifically they did that. I know that the anti-gravity technology in and of itself distorts time and space as we know it, so they could go anywhere, anytime. So that's a whole other avenue of research that I have not delved into as yet.
All right, we have a flash message from Paul in Australia. It's rather long. Let me summarize. There are reports on the internet that Julian Assange with WikiLeaks is going to be releasing some files that talk about UFOs. And the some of those stories reference that what's going to be revealed is that the United States has been at battle with UFOs in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica since 2004. Mm-hmm. How does this fit into your article, and what do you think about that?
Well, you can use your own imagination with this one. I just saw this article on WikiLeaks. They said that we almost launched World War III because a flight of UFOs was on track from the Antarctic headed for North America, and that they stopped and changed course, returned to the Antarctic They got as far north as Guatemala, and they turned around and went back south. So that's you know, use your own imagination.
Now, is that something that's actually in
story, an unverified account according to WikiLeaks? But the implication there is like, well, somebody or something is going on, or is, has some kind of a base in the Antarctic. And of course,
okay, now is that something
that's German?
Okay, can you hear me, Jim?
Yes.
All right, is that something that was published in the WikiLeaks cables, or is that something that somebody else published and said was in the WikiLeaks cables?
The article that I saw was on YouTube, and it was something that somebody said was in WikiLeaks, as I understand it, as I recall.
Got you. Okay. The telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 623-444-5889. And the telephone line is open. The toll-free number in the USA and Canada is 888-223-4599. And if you're outside of the USA and Canada, we do have the flash message option on my website. So just go over to kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, look on the right side of the page. You will see where it says flash message if you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada. But now look, folks, when we open up the phone lines and you don't call, please don't be one of the people that sends me one of those nasty emails saying, well, why didn't you ask this and why didn't you say that? The lines are open, and if you've got a question, it's your job to ask it, okay? Now, look, Jim, this whole WikiLeaks thing is pretty interesting. Have you noticed that it's gotten very, very quiet? The whole WikiLeaks thing has gone very quiet since Assange said he was going to release UFO cables.
Well, I'm very cautious about putting a whole lot of credibility in WikiLeaks UFO information as yet. It's very tantalizing. It's very interesting. I want to know what they have to say, but I'm not quite ready to hang my hat on it just yet. So that's we'll just have to see how this develops.
Well,
have you done a show with Joseph Farrell?
Oh, many.
Joseph, I would love to continue our show tonight with Joseph Farrell and Jim Mars and just keep going with this German issue, because I think Joseph would have some very, very keen insights about where, who, where, what has happened with that base in the Antarctic since World War II.
Yeah, I've done a number of shows over the years with Joseph Farrell and with Jim Mars as well.
Exactly.
And had both of them on fairly recently. We will be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Let me apologize to those of you watching on our TV channel. During the break, for some reason, it just decided to lock up and stop broadcasting on the TV channel, although no problem for those on radio. One of the great benefits of radio, by the way. My guest is Jim Nichols. The telephone lines are open, 623-444-5889, or toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. If you're outside the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can use the flash message option. The flash message option is on my website at kevinsmithshow.com. Jim, when we went away for break, I had a thought. It's an unusual thing to happen to me, but it happened. I had a thought. Do you remember the story about, this was in the early 1900s, a UFO that's in Texas that near Fort Worth, by the way, that struck a windlass, which is a sort of a windmill that runs a pump. You remember that? And it crashed? It was a cylindrical shape. And when I was visiting in Texas a few months ago, a local, and I can't remember, I think it was Allen, Texas, I think is the name of the place. It's a very, very small town. It's still there, partially. But there have been documentaries on television where they went out and they dug in a well and looked for parts that supposedly were dumped into this well, parts of the UFO. But I talked with a local who told me that's not where it happened. And I said, well, where did it happen? And this local took me to where it happened. It's about a mile from that location that was in the documentary. And this particular location is directly across the road from the Kenneth Copeland Ministries, which is a huge, huge complex. They bought an old military airport that's still listed as active for USMC, U.S. Marine Corps, and they bought it. But directly across the road from that is where this local told me that the actual crash took place.
I believe I've read about that over the years, but offhand, I'm not real familiar with the story.
Yeah, but what interests me was it was a cylindrical shaped craft.
Right, right.
And so you know these have been around for a long time. This would have been before there was such a thing as the Zeppelin. Okay, so this is not. This would not have been, oh, well, that was just, you know, a prototype for the Zeppelin. Nah, this is decades before the Zeppelin.
Well, I think back during the 1800s, there were other alleged sightings of strange things flying around that I think inspired Jules Verne to write his book. He wrote a book called Master of the World, which is like a Captain Nemo kind of character who had built a strange flying machine.
Yeah.
And I think that Jules Verne book was based on some of the strange sightings that were being seen around the world in that time.
Well, how did you get interested in UFOs? I mean, you have produce some of the best UFO illustrations ever. So how did you get interested in UFOs?
Well, Kevin, I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 1948, and I was raised watching the television. And I loved the science fiction movies that they would show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just simply a product of that era. I love the... I watched the Walt Disney stuff, and I love science and science fiction, and love the flying saucer movies, you know, Earth versus the flying saucers, and Invaders from Mars, and things like that. I used to race home. Weeknights, we had the TV movie was The Big Show. They'd show The Big Show every night.
Mm-hmm.
About the time I'd get home from school, and just about every week or so, they'd show these old science fiction movies, and I just grew up loving that stuff. And of course, there was, at the same time in the early 50s, there was all this talk about flying saucers, and George Adamski was, his books were bestsellers in those days, and it just all, you know, I'm a science fiction brat. I mean, think about it. We were born into a science fiction reality. When they dropped the atomic bomb in Hiroshima in 1945, we entered a science fiction world, and we've been living in that ever since. So flying saucers and rockets and Sputniks were as much a part of my life as hot dogs and soda pop. So that's what I was born into, and that's what I loved. And it's like, when I got into doing the art, I didn't set out to be a UFO artist, I will say that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be an artist, but eventually my art, evolved into more science fiction themes, and then it just seemed natural to start doing pictures of flying saucers. But it was not until 1980 when I met Wendell Stevens, who was a serious UFO researcher, did I actually decide to start doing, serious UFO illustrations.
Have UFOs moved from science fiction to reality for you?
Wow, that's a good question. I suppose after 30 years, it's like I can't tell the difference anymore.
That's a good answer, because I have made the same statement.
Years, it's all blends together.
I've made the same statement on this show that we live in a sci-fi world.
We do.
And things that we think are just science fiction really exist out there, and many of those things actually exist, because the true state of technology is, 100 years ahead of where we are at the consumer level.
I'd say, Kevin, I'd say it's beyond that.
Yeah.
I'd say it's beyond that, and I say that the distance between where the science behind closed doors is grows exponentially every year. So it may be 1,000 years ahead of us by now.
So when we see Captain Kirk saying, "Beam me up, Scotty," and people think, "Oh, that's just science fiction, they can't do that," they probably really can.
Tell that to Andrew Basciago. He will say that, "Beam me up, Scotty" is a everyday viable reality in certain areas of of our military industrial complex.
Yeah. All right. I want to thank you for being with us, Jim. And if you will, just stay on the line with us for a moment as I close the show. I want to chat with you a moment after the show. Folks, Jim Nichols, real pleasure to have him with us. Many of the illustrations you see around the web and in publications having to do with UFOs are the work of this man. He himself is a UFO researcher and writer. Check out the blog articles on his website, and you can see some of the pictures there too. But check out those blog articles. Excellent, excellent writer about UFO research. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me, just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.